This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 27th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 12th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, massive tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Think Realty, Coach Fullerton, Keller Williams Corona, Property Radar, The Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
I thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today we have a very special guest, Christopher Thornburg. Christopher founded Beacon Economics, LLC in 2006, one of the most respected research organizations in California, serving public and private sectors, clients across the United States. In 2015, Dr. Thornburg also became director of the UC Riverside School of Business Center for Economic Forecasting and Development and an adjunct professor at the school. Christopher is an expert in economic and revenue forecasting, regional economics, economic policy, and labor and real estate markets. He consults for private industry, cities, counties, and public agencies across the country. He became nationally known for forecasting the subprime market crash that began in 2007 and was one of the few economists on record to predict the global economic recession that followed. I'll add, Christopher, you are one of the few people that I risk taking the chance to ask questions I do not know the answers to myself, which makes this a very fun interview for me. And thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Always great to be here, Bruce.
Okay. I guess I've kind of a broad question. How do you feel about the U.S. economy? Are we healthy or headed to a recession?
We're healthy. You know, it's interesting. The more things stay the same, the more the court of public opinion changes. The ebbs and flows of these headlines we've been seeing are really far more variable than the actual ebbs and flows of our economy today. This latest round of pessimism really started at the end of last year with the slowdown in the residential real estate market, the big sell-off in the stock market. And it's interesting, we're almost 9 months later, and it feels to me like the press is not just saying we're going to have a recession. They have basically convinced themselves that there will be a recession, and they're talking about the consequences for millennials, for the election, and everything else. And yet, even as they continue to just hype this downturn, the economy keeps trucking along. You look at the numbers. Consumer spending is good. Business investment is fine. For all the worries of a trade war, exports are higher today than they were this year at last time. The credit markets look fine. You can go on and on about how, really, outside of just a couple things, the U.S. economy looks about as healthy as it has in the last 25 years.
Well, to kind of verify what you're saying, we got a 50-year low in unemployment. You got decent GDP growth. Well, then what in the world are we doing with a 1.5% 10-year T-bill this morning?
Well, you have to ask the bond markets. They're going to know that answer better than I. Obviously, there are two things going on here. One is, at least in the financial world, there has been a degree of panic. And, of course, when you panic, you run to the safety of bonds. And that's probably one of the short-term drivers of it. But the other thing, and this is something we've talked about in the past, is that we still live in a world that is candidly awash with excess liquidity. you just have a lot of money floating around out there looking for a place to call home. And that kind of world typically leads to low interest rates. So, you know, I have been said pretty consistently over the last 5 years that there's just doesn't seem to be any way the 10-year bonds gets to 4% in the near term. I have been sticking to that for a while, and I think that subsiding from a little bit over 3% back to where it is right now is just more indication that the true long-run bond rate in this economy is probably in the 2.5% range.
Okay. The U.S. economy, when I was in high school, was about 38% of the world economy. Now it's about 24%. Does that mean that what's happening outside the U.S. has more impact on our economy than it used to?
Yes and no. At one level, you could say that the U.S. and exposure to the rest of the world doesn't really occur by relative sizes. It occurs through imports and exports. And if you think about imports and exports as a percent of GDP, well, they're higher now than they were 50 years ago. But relative to much of the world, they're still really not all that high. And we have to remember that more and more of the U.S. economy is turning towards services, which really doesn't compete on the world marketplace. So in a very real sense, we are isolated from global issues more so than most places in the world. And you, again, see that right now because the U.S. economy is hardly noticing some of the turmoil going on out there, and particularly, of course, in China and in Europe.
Okay. Back in the last quarter of 2018, the Fed's stated intent was they were going to raise rates until they got to a more normal rate environment. And within 60 days or so, the whole direction changed, and now it's actually gaining momentum. So what has the Fed seen that they hadn't realized?
Well, I'm not sure the Fed actually ever said that they were raising rates to a quote-unquote normal rate. If they did, then they should be throwing out the vast majority of chairmen, including Powell, because that's a ludicrous thing to say.
They did. Yeah,
there is no such thing as a normal rate.
Okay. Well, yeah, it is something he said, but you're right. He shouldn't have said it.
Well, that goes back to the point, which is I've said all along, you know, and while lawyers have a lot of use in this world, it strikes me that having a lawyer in charge of the central bank seems, at best, dangerous. And certainly that kind of rhetoric shows us just what we're dealing with. Look, there's no such thing as normal rates. The rates will go where the markets tell them to go. Yes, the Federal Reserve has control over the lower end of the yield curve, but everything above that is driven by the whims of investors at various levels. Of course, they did tighten all the way through the end of last year, and then they got caught with their pants down. The stock market dumped, the bond market rallied, long-run rates dropped below short-run rates, and suddenly all his plans of quote-unquote normalization are gone. Now he has to start unwinding and dropping those lower rates and then getting that yield curve unwound. Because, you know, an inverted yield curve is just creates excessive amounts of stress on the banking system, unnecessary stress in the banking system.
When the Fed usually starts moving with that tool, they usually have a 4 or 5% move potentially. This time it's less than half of that. So how does that impact the ability for that particular tool to do its job?
Well, by doing its job, I think what you're suggesting is, you know, do they have an ability to deal with some sort of business cycle, some sort of downturn in the economy? And we know that. We already saw what happened back in the Great Recession when they didn't really have the short end to operate with. They pushed rates down to nearly zero, and it just wasn't working. So they went to quantitative easing. There is a whole second set of tools out there. In fact, there's even a third set of tools, which is direct stimulus, where they just print money and mail it out to U.S. residents. They have other options. This isn't the only tool. And candidly, I would also argue that in a very real way, maybe it's time to dump the federal funds rate as a quote-unquote cyclical tool. If I look back over the last 40, 50 years, I see the Federal Reserve desperately trying to move the U.S. economy off specific dangerous paths with, candidly, almost no impact. We are constantly fed the myth of the all-powerful Federal Reserve. Every time you pick up the Wall Street Journal or turn on CNBC, they just go on and on, all hail the mighty Fed. And in reality, they don't have anywhere near the power in our economy people think. And candidly, I often argue that, you know, maybe it's good to burst the bubble a little bit, let people understand that while the Fed has an important job, they don't have all this power. We have to understand that what they can do is relatively limited.
Okay. So quantitative easing, since they don't have that much room, quantitative easing, is that the next tool that'll be implemented, and how soon will that?
Exactly. Quantitative easing would be where you go next, and that's just buying up a bunch of bonds and using the cash that's generated by buying those bonds to stimulate the economy. Now, again, that still all works through the banking system, and if the banks aren't willing to lend that money for whatever reason, they're paralyzed or capital constrained or too risk adverse, that's when you go straight to direct injections of liquidity into the economy. And that's when the Federal Reserve just writes basically every man, woman, and child in the United States, I don't know, you name your number, $250 check, just mails it to everybody. That would get things rocking and rolling, right?
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a history that you know probably more. I guess it would certainly seem to spur some things. It might spur a lot of bad habits, too. But at any rate,
it might spur a lot of bad habits. It probably spur a lot of TV buying, which would be good for the Chinese economy. So I hear you. It isn't a perfect tool, but it definitely would do something.
Yeah. Okay. It would also increase the debt. Would that not be true? Is that a federal?
I'm sorry, one more time.
Is that a federal debt increase when you decide to give away stuff?
No, because it's the Federal Reserve. Remember, the Federal Reserve is independent from the federal government. They're different beasts completely. The federal government operates on revenues and debt. The Federal Reserve functionally has power over the money supply. There's no such thing. You know, it's funny. You know, every once in a while you'll hear one of these anti-Fed people, and they'll say things like, "Well, what if the Fed goes bankrupt?" That's not possible. Well, what about their balance sheet? It's completely imaginary. It's hard for people to understand that when you can print your own money, you don't operate by the same rules that your average household or business operates by. It's a different kind of beast. And in that sense, yeah, they do have a lot of power. But the kind of power we're talking about is more power of the money supply. One of the things I am worried about is the fact that the money supply, growth in the money supply, has slowed dramatically over the course of the last 4, 5, 6 months, driven by the end of quantitative easing. You know, if you're worried about low interest rates, you don't want low inflation. You don't want low money supply growth. If anything, the Federal Reserve should be turning on the spigots. They should be expanding the money supply quicker. Because that would actually, I think, do a lot to increase inflation, maybe push interest rates up a bit, unwind that yield curve, give the economy a little bit of breathing room. It makes a lot of sense to move to a higher inflation target in this environment. But again, our government just seems so obsessed with the status quo. There's just very little appetite for actually trying to break out and do something different.
With the demographics that are in place, not only in our country, but around the world, is that inherently deflationary or inflationary?
None of the above. You know, the kind of things you're talking about there, you know, economists discuss in theoretical ways. But as a guy who actually sits down with the data and talks about inflation, and it's really hard to pick out demographic and savings effects in the inflation data. The short-run drivers of money supply and economic growth are far more dominant.
Okay. ran across the concept of debt jubilee. So can you tell me what that is, and is that likely to occur at some point? A debt jubilee. It's actually a forgiveness of debt. I've created a new term. Hey, that's impressive.
I never heard of that.
Okay.
You completely caught me off guard there. Well, I'm not sure why would we be talking about debt forgiveness. I mean, I realize that forgiving college debt has been the platform of some of the folks running for president on the Democratic side of the ledger. But I'm a little confused why we would discuss any kind of debt forgiveness.
Debt
markets look pretty good right now. Well, debt to income ratios continue to fall. Delinquency rates look great. The financial obligation ratio is near an all-time record low. I'm not sure whose debt we will be forgiving and why.
Well, let's use two examples. You know, again, I caught you off guard, and that was unintentional. But it's a word I just heard the last couple of weeks. But I'll use two things. We have promises that we've made to people that are retired. And you and I have talked before that the math does not work. So a debt jubilee is like hitting a reset button and getting back to a truthful number. And Japan as a country might have the same scenario where their debt is so high, it's sort of unfixable.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I think those comparisons are completely wrong.
Okay, good.
Yeah, because while the debt and the need for future social services in Japan are very high, we have to remember that over the past 20 or 30 years, Japan has consistently been running a trade surplus. And what that means is, for the most part, they have been bringing in more assets than selling to the rest of the world. And that means that there is a lot of savings over there that at some level goes to offsetting some of those obligations. The other thing about Japan to keep in mind is actually the services they have for dealing with seniors, particularly healthcare, are vastly more efficient than they are here. In fact, you could actually argue that levels of healthcare in Japan are running about 40% of what they are here in the United States on a per senior basis.
Okay.
So, you know, the numbers are obviously a little bit worrisome over there, and surely they need more immigration. But I would go so far as to suggest they're in much better shape than we are. I mean, we can't even balance our budget right now. In fact, if anything, the Republicans have seemed to have gone out of their way to blow out the federal deficit at a level that almost seems, I mean, irresponsible would be the softest term I could use. Absolutely crazy, particularly given the platform of the Republican Party is a little bit more honest. It's just amazing how they have blown out the deficit.
Like you, I probably get emails from out of the blue from people just knowing, you know, hey, you might be interested in this. And somebody sent me an email this last week where Denmark, you can borrow real estate debt on a 10-year loan at minus a half.
Yeah, I saw that.
I was just scratching my head going, okay, well, how does that work for the lender? How does the banking system make money at a minus number?
You know, negative interest rates are something that a lot of economists have pondered. And I think they're driven largely by, of course, just issues within the regulatory systems, particularly when it comes to banks and various sorts of financial funds over in Europe. They have to put their money someplace. And unfortunately, that could lead to the kind of bidding wars that lead to these kind of odd outcomes. But ultimately, you know, I wouldn't overread into it. You know, it's easy to get all hot and bothered about such things when, you know, realistically, the numbers we're talking about are pretty small. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. A year from now, do you expect the 10-year T-bill to be higher than it is right now or lower?
I do. I think it's going to bounce back some when people realize that all this panic over the economy is kind of nonsensical. So I think it's going to start drifting up for those people out there thinking about refinancing. This is a great time to go ahead and jump in and do it, take advantage of this. But again, they're, you know, if they get up to 3%, that'll be about as high as they go on the other side of it. You know.
Well, that's double where we
and
are.
Geez, Bruce, all this time, we haven't even talked about real estate. But
Well, we kind of have.
A little bit, right. But, you know, all the signs show, again, that the panic over real estate is more nonsense. And you've seen all sorts of statistics that suggest things are starting to turn. You know, a lot of folks sitting on the sidelines waiting for prices to fall 20% to get that steal of a deal who are about to be very disappointed in the second half of 2019, let me tell you.
Well, it's really hard to have a price decline of any significance if you don't have a bunch of foreclosures in the system. And there's no way we're going to have a bunch of foreclosures with all the fixed rate loans in place, with people with good credit, down payments, and left their equity in place. There's no way.
No way. Couldn't agree more. And so I was just laughing over the last 6-7 months. Again, all the bears prognosticating the end of the big rally. Again, turns out economy's just fine, housing market's just fine.
Okay, trade war with China. So again, it doesn't seem like it impacts real estate, but it's a big topic. And I have a feeling one of the reasons we're at the interest rates we are is something like that. So how big of a deal is that? The trade war.
Again, at the risk of sounding repetitive, it's not. While I don't agree with much of what comes out of the president's mouth, when he says that China is paying the tariffs, he is largely right. Yes, I understand that from a technical standpoint, it's the importer that pays that tax. But you got to remember that the Chinese are far more at risk of a big slowdown in trade with the United States than the other way around, and they know that. So they have taken the very strategic approach of saying, look, we have to maintain volume. Let's not worry about profits until we get past this administration. So they've allowed the yuan to depreciate sharply, down 12-13% from where it was a year ago. A lot of suppliers over there are cutting their prices to American suppliers because the American suppliers tell them they have to, and they don't have a lot of option. The American buyers. And the net result really is yes, there's been a little bit of a slowdown in imports from China, but nowhere near as dramatic as one would have thought, given the size of these particular tariffs. Really, the story is more about exports to China, because the Chinese have gone out of their way and tried to politically punish the United States by systemically choosing particular industries to just not buy stuff from. Soy, of course, would be a famous example. Autos are getting whacked. Airplanes are also kind of in the crosshairs. So they're making very strategic decisions, again, trying to score political points, even as they wait out Trump on this particular issue. If you look back a couple of months, it feels to me at least like the president figured it out, because if you remember after the last round of negotiations, he exploded all sorts of tweets and threats, and that was all the, you know, clear realization on his part that they were playing him.
Okay.
So what does he do? He you know, goes into a froth over it, doesn't like being played, and, you know, I'm sure that wasn't making the Chinese happy, although things have cooled off just a bit. It is clear that they're the ones who are suffering from this. For us, it hardly matters.
Does a trade war turn into a currency war? And if so, what impact does that have on the U.S. interest rates or economy?
Well, it already has, right, in the sense that China has allowed the yuan to depreciate. The dollar has been riding a little bit high because of that. Now, typically, a strong dollar would tend to be driven by high interest rates and vice versa. We are in an interesting phenomenon with the dollars becoming strong, even as interest rates go low. But again, in a global slowdown, the United States is often seen as a safe haven, and you'll see a lot of money coming here. And that's what's driving this particular set of indicators.
As is always our case when I get to interview you, I have 3 hours of questions, and I have time for one last one. But it's really an interesting one to me. So here's the question. 2020 election, Let's suppose we have a Democrat president and both houses of Congress are as well. What direction will we likely take regarding climate change, and how will that impact the economy?
I tell you what, let's finish on a real easy question to answer. Well, look, if the Democrats do sweep and they manage to keep themselves together, because you remember the old line by Mark Twain, I do not belong to an organized political party. I am a Democrat, right?
Right.
So there's a very high likelihood that, you know, they will end up infighting and spatting with each other the way they do. And it's in those sort of circumstances, they don't necessarily get a lot done. I mean, you think about for 2 years how Trump had complete sweep of the different forces for power there and couldn't get much done either. So,
yes.
But let's say they do manage to keep together and start thinking about climate change. I see them putting a lot of rules in place to start cleaning up the different parts of the energy markets. Do I think it's going to have a big impact on our economy? No, I don't. Unlike, say, 20 years ago, we have a lot more tools in our renewable energy toolbox. Solar is cheap. Wind is cheap. There are ways for us to do this. And while they will obviously impact some people's pocketbooks, overall, the broader health of the U.S. economy is such that we will be able to overcome some of these challenges. I think it's a good thing for us to do. We are at a tipping point, and it's about time we grow up and be a little responsible. Maybe we won't all have as many sports cars in the garage as we want. But I think that if you take a step back and realize the prosperity that Americans are currently enjoying, despite the ridiculous political rhetoric to the contrary, you start to realize that we really are the most spoiled generation ever. And it's time for us to, man up and do our part to fix this mess we've made.
Okay. Hey, I've enjoyed it as always. And thanks for being the guy I can ask questions I don't know the answer to. And I
there are a couple I didn't know the answer to either.
Well, that was great. I love batting it around with you. I have no ego at stake. I love to learn. So, all right, Chris, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Hey, and Chris, if people
always
would like
pleasure,
to
sir.
Follow
always
your work, well, where would you like them to go to follow your work? Is it Beacon Economics website?
Yes, beaconecon.com.
Okay.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan and Associates, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Shenbaum Group, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering, Wilson Investment Properties. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.